Imagine being trapped in a small wooden boat about 700 feet below sea level, where the actual physical shape of the mountains around you is literally designed to funnel a hurricane right onto your head.
It is a terrifying thought.
Right. I mean, for centuries, we've kind of treated the landscape of historical accounts as this passive, dusty backdrop, just a blank void where the plot happens. But welcome to today's deep dive. We are thrilled you're here. Today, our mission is to realize that the geography is actually the main character.
Oh, absolutely.
We are mapping the historical geography of Galilee today, and we're relying really heavily on the brilliant framework laid out by Dr. Elaine Phillips, basically to decode the where so you can truly understand the what and the why.
Yeah, it completely rewires your understanding of the history. When you start to, overlay the topography onto these ancient events, you realize that Galilee wasn't just the static place where things occurred, it actively provoked those
Provoke
events.
them how? Like
Yeah.
geographically.
Well, geographically and politically. To really grasp the volatile nature of the first century, we have to look at Galilee as the ultimate land between. This was a region that was just perpetually caught in a geopolitical vice grip. It was fought over endlessly by the Seleucids to the north up in Syria and the Ptolemies to the south in Egypt.
Which means the local population is essentially suffering from centuries of like geographic whiplash.
Exactly.
And the cultural layers are just as complex because, due to Alexander the Great's earlier campaigns, this whole area is heavily steeped in Hellenism and Greek culture.
Yeah.
But what really stood out to me when looking into this is what happened about a century before Jesus.
Right, the Maccabean period.
Yes, you have the descendants of the Maccabees, specifically Aristobulus, I think around 104 BC, sweeping in and forcibly bringing Galilee under the control of an independent Jewish state. And they actually made the indigenous population convert to Judaism under threat.
Yeah, and that forced conversion, I mean, that is the match that lights the powder keg. You have indigenous peoples who have been living under heavy Hellenistic influence, and suddenly they're forced into strict Jewish observance. And all of this is happening while being occupied by the Roman Empire.
Talk about a high-stress environment.
Right. The friction there isn't just political. It is deeply personal. It's cultural. It creates this highly reactive environment. I mean, it is the perfect volatile stage for a radical movement to launch.
So let's look at the physical stage itself, starting with Lower Galilee, because that geographic whiplash we just talked about, it applies to the weather too.
Oh, heavily.
Yeah, the traditional narrative always mentions these sudden, terrifying storms on the Sea of Galilee. And I'll be honest, I always picture them as just, bad luck. But the thermodynamics at play here are completely wild.
The landscape is quite literally engineered to create violent weather. If you look at a map, the valleys in Lower Galilee run horizontally, so west to east. And because you have these prevailing winds blowing off the Mediterranean Sea, these east-west valleys act as massive geographical funnels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they catch those heavy, moisture-laden maritime storm systems, compress them, and basically blast them eastward.
Right into a massive atmospheric depression because the Sea of Galilee is sitting 700 feet below sea level.
Exactly. Which means you have this deep basin filled with warm, humid, stagnant air just sitting there. So when that funneled cold, moist air from the Mediterranean shoots down the slopes and collides with that warm
I hear a
basin,
bomb going off.
it triggers an explosive thermodynamic reaction. The sudden temperature differential causes the air to churn violently. So when we read accounts of fishermen guys who knew that lake better than anyone, genuinely terrified for their lives during a sudden squall, it wasn't some spiritual exaggeration.
Right, they weren't just being dramatic.
No, not at all. The topography was literally a meteorological bowling alley designed to drop a storm on them without warning.
That funnel of chaos completely changes the texture of those maritime stories. But, the geography didn't just funnel the weather, it funneled the culture too.
Definitely.
I really want to look at Nazareth because we have this pervasive, almost Sunday school image of Jesus as this folksy, isolated rural carpenter tucked away in the quiet hills, just working with wood.
Right.
But Nazareth is only about 3.5 miles from Sepphoris.
Yes.
Wait, so if Nazareth is basically in the backyard of this massive, wealthy Greco-Roman capital, how does that square with our traditional image? I mean, wouldn't he have been exposed to all of that urban sprawl?
Oh, he absolutely would have. Sepphoris was a bustling administrative and cultural hub. It was heavily built up by Herod Antipas during that time. I mean, it was the absolute center of local commerce.
So not just a quiet little village next door.
Not at all. For a craftsman living in a tiny village like Nazareth, Sepphoris was where the work was. it is highly probable that a local tradesman or stonemason like Jesus's father, Joseph, would simply commute over the ridge to work on those massive construction projects.
And one of those projects was a massive theater cut straight into the bedrock.
Yes.
This part fascinated me. I learned that the Greek word for actor is actually hypocrite. And we see Jesus use that specific word 17 times in the Gospels to describe religious leaders.
It's a very specific choice of words.
Yeah. If he's growing up 3 miles from a major Roman capital with a bedrock theater, it completely changes the tone of his teaching. Like, these aren't folksy rural musings. These are sharp, street-smart observations of a bustling Greco-Roman economy.
Exactly. He is speaking an incredibly specific visual language. He watched those literal actors, those hypocrites, put on their masks and perform in that theater just over the hill from his house.
Wow.
So when he weaponized that term against the religious elite, his audience didn't hear some abstract theological concept. They saw the actors in Sepphoris. The landscape literally provided the exact vocabulary he needed.
So the landscape gives them their weather. It dictates their economy. But it also serves as this massive physical hard drive for their historical memory.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
The locals knew the stories attached to every single hill. We all know the story of Jonah. But what we forget, or what I didn't know, is that his hometown, Gath Hepher, was essentially right there in the neighborhood.
Yeah, just a stone's throw away. And that changes the dynamic completely when Jesus invokes the sign of Jonah to the local religious leaders. He isn't just, you know, pulling a random text from a scroll.
Right.
He is pointing to a local boy. He's leveraging the hometown pride and the immediate geographic memory of his audience to make his point land with maximum impact.
But the geographic echo that really blew my mind happens near Mount Moore. So in the Old Testament, we have the legendary account of the prophet Elisha raising a dead boy back to life in a town called Shunem.
Yes.
Fast forward hundreds of years to the Gospel of Luke, and Jesus encounters a funeral procession for a widow's dead son, and he raises the boy back to life. And this happens in the town of Nain. And Nain is located right around the corner from Shunem. They're practically sharing the same view of the mountain. So my question is this just a coincidence of his travel itinerary? Or is he intentionally choosing these exact coordinates?
The overlap is far too precise to be an accident. He is deliberately walking onto the exact same geographical stage where Elisha performed his miracle. By recreating the event in almost the exact same location, he literally forces the crowd to connect the historical dots.
That is wild.
Right. So when the people react by shouting, "A great prophet is among us," it's not simply a reaction to a miraculous event. It's a reaction to the physical context.
The location itself is part of the message.
Exactly. The landscape itself was validating his identity as the successor to the great prophets.
It's like a modern director shooting a pivotal scene on the residual set pieces of a legendary movie just to evoke a really specific emotional response from the audience.
Yeah, it's a perfect analogy.
So if he's intentionally utilizing these stages, then leaving Nazareth, you know, after they nearly threw him off the cliff at the Mount of Precipitation, it wasn't just a retreat. His decision to relocate his home base down to Capernaum was a highly calculated move.
Oh, it was brilliant logistics. Capernaum is situated right near the Plain of Gennesaret. The historian Josephus read extensively about this area, noting its incredible fertility: walnuts, palms, figs. I mean, it all grew there.
A real breadbasket.
Exactly. But more importantly, archaeological excavations have revealed that Capernaum was a massive industrial center for processing olive oil.
Yeah, I saw the records of the heavy basalt olive presses they unearthed there. And the sheer number of them proves this wasn't just, you know, small-scale subsistence farming. This was heavy industry.
Heavy is the key word. Think about how those presses operated. You have a massive, incredibly dense basalt millstone. A wooden post is driven through the center, and animals, or sometimes laborers, push it in a circle over a stone basin to crush the olives.
Right.
These things were monstrously heavy.
Which injects an element of absolute terror into his teaching in Matthew 18. He tells the crowd it would be better to have a large millstone hung around your neck and be thrown into the sea.
Right.
If you're standing in Capernaum listening to this, you know exactly how much those basalt stones weigh. You work with them every single day, and you're standing right next to the water. The visceral horror of that image is magnified tenfold by the industrial reality of their town.
It's incredibly vivid, and beyond the heavy industry, Capernaum was a geopolitical hotspot. It sat directly on the border between the territory controlled by Herod Antipas and the region controlled by his brother Philip.
Okay.
And it was also a key stop on the International Coastal Highway.
And where you have international highways crossing territorial borders, you have tolls, tariffs, and tax collectors, which perfectly explains why a tax collector like Levi Matthew would be stationed right there in a booth to be called as a disciple.
Exactly. It's prime real estate for a tax booth.
But this raises a major question for me. If I am launching a spiritual movement, I want a quiet, peaceful sanctuary to build my core team. But he deliberately relocates to a loud, highly taxed industrial border town. Why seek out that intense friction instead of avoiding it?
Well, you have to look at the historical trauma embedded in that specific region to understand why he went there. The text explicitly mentions he moves to this area to fulfill Isaiah 9, bringing the Prince of Peace to the land.
Okay, but why did they need peace so desperately right there?
Decades earlier, when Herod the Great was violently securing his rule, Jewish rebels hid out in the cliff caves at a place called Arbel.
Oh, I've read about this.
Yeah, it's right over the pass that the international highway runs through. Josephus details this horrific military operation where Herod's soldiers were literally lowered down the sheer cliff faces in baskets to slaughter the defenders inside their caves.
The accounts say the Sea of Galilee literally ran red with blood during those campaigns.
It was a landscape scarred by horrific violence. The people walking in darkness had literally seen their water turn to blood. So Jesus didn't retreat to a sanitized sanctuary. He walked directly into the epicenter of the trauma, the taxation, and the noise.
Wow.
He offered the alternative, the Prince of Peace, on the exact ground where the pain and political friction were most acute.
That drastically changes the emotional weight of his ministry there. It's not just a backdrop. It's a direct confrontation of that pain.
Exactly.
But let's zoom in a bit. We've looked at the macroeconomy of Capernaum's olive presses and the border politics. But the micro level, like the actual domestic architecture of the homes, is just as revealing.
Oh, the architecture is fascinating.
Yeah, because the structural reality of how these people lived completely shifts our understanding of one of the most famous promises in history.
Right, because the architecture of first century Galilee was entirely distinct from how we build today. They didn't have standalone single family homes. They lived in structures called insulae, these interconnected sprawling dwelling units.
Kind of like a compound.
Exactly. The cultural mechanism behind it was really interesting. A patriarch would build a core house. And when his son became betrothed, the son didn't just go out and buy his own plot of land to start a new separate life.
Instead, during that betrothal period, the son would literally build an addition onto his father's existing house.
Precisely. He would share a wall, basically extending the family compound. And the father would eventually inspect the new room, and only when he deemed it ready could the son go and bring his bride back to her new home.
That is so different from how we do things.
It really is. Some of these insular complexes in Capernaum grew horizontally to encompass up to 15 interconnected rooms. They acted as these massive, bustling family communes.
Knowing that marital tradition and that architectural reality completely shatters our modern reading of John 14.
Oh, entirely.
Because we have this deeply ingrained Western ideal of the standalone, fenced-in mega mansion. So when Jesus says, "In my Father's house are many rooms, I go to prepare a place for you," we picture this solitary, opulent estate in the clouds.
Right, we picture a private mansion. But he is deliberately using the imagery of the insula. He's speaking directly as a first century bridegroom. The promise isn't about giving you a private estate so you can live in isolated luxury.
Right.
The promise is that he is adding a room onto the family compound.
It changes the entire paradigm. It shifts from a promise of, like, material reward to a promise of ultimate belonging.
Yes. Beautifully said.
The goal wasn't isolation. It was inclusion into a massive, ever-expanding, extended family. The theology is literally baked into the dirt and mortar of their daily lives.
And if the insulae of Capernaum demonstrated a theology of intimate domestic inclusion, Jesus needed an entirely different, almost terrifyingly public backdrop to declare his ultimate authority.
Okay, where does he go for that?
Well, that's why he eventually takes his disciples out of the familiar domestic rhythm of the evangelical triangle, you know, the towns of Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida, and marches them north into a completely alien landscape.
Right to the headwaters of the Jordan River, to Caesarea Philippi. And physically, this place is overwhelming. I was looking at the descriptions. It sits at the foothills of Mount Hermon and features the largest karstic spring in the Middle East. You have, like, 5,000 gallons of water per second violently exploding out of the limestone. But visually and culturally, it's incredibly dark.
It was the absolute epicenter of pagan worship in the region. Herod the Great built a colossal temple to Caesar Augustus there. Then you had the worship of Pan, the god of nature and fertility, alongside Zeus, and even Nemesis, the god of revenge and the dead.
Just a massive collection of deities.
Exactly. And the architecture matched the theology. They carved these massive niches directly into a towering, stark rock bluff and placed the statues of these gods inside them.
So you're standing in front of this towering cliff face, deafened by the roar of the spring, staring up at a wall of dead stone gods.
Right.
And it is exactly against this intimidating sensory overload backdrop that Jesus turns to his followers and asks, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter looks at this wall of stone and declares him the Son of the living God.
The visual contrast is just astounding. And Jesus' response leverages the geography perfectly. He points to the landscape and says, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it."
Which is such a famous line.
It is. But there is a crucial translation nuance here that shifts the entire tone of the interaction.
Yes. This is the part that completely rewired my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have always pictured this defensively, like a fortress.
We all do. But the Greek preposition used here can also be translated as against this rock.
Wait, really? Against?
Yes. He isn't just saying he's going to use a rock as a foundation. He's pointing directly at that massive cliff face, the center of pagan worship and the supposed domain of the dead, and saying, against this rock.
Oh, wow.
And when he mentions the gates of Hades, we have to remember the actual function of a gate.
Right. Gates are defensive structures. They don't attack. They protect what's inside. So if the gates of hell won't overcome the movement, it means the movement isn't the one playing defense. We aren't supposed to picture believers cowering behind a wall while hell attacks them. The geography suggests the exact opposite, that the church is the battering ram.
It's an aggressive, offensive siege against the darkest, most fortified stronghold on the map. The gates of the underworld will try to hold out, but they will fail. He took them to the most visually intimidating place possible, not to hide, but to launch the attack.
It's an absolutely incredible visual. I mean, by simply overlaying a map onto the text, we've seen how violent west-east weather funnels, massive basalt millstones, horizontally expanding family homes, and towering cliffs of dead gods weren't just background scenery. They were the curriculum.
They really were. And when we strip away the geography, we run the risk of turning gritty, historical reality into abstract fairy tales.
Yeah, we lose the impact.
We do. The dirt matters. The architecture matters. The trade routes matter. These texts are grounded in a real complex world and understanding that physical reality is the only way to accurately decode the message.
So as we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over. If the physical geography of the first century, you know, its trade routes, its border taxes, its architecture, its weather patterns, so deeply shaped the metaphors and the messages of history, what is the invisible topography shaping your life right now?
That's a great question.
Yeah, how is our modern digital geography, our current land between of algorithms, endless feeds, and virtual borders, dictating the script of what you believe and how you communicate today? Something to think about. Thanks for diving deep with us. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll see you next time.